Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man that we turn to frequently to discuss what's happening in our own hemisphere is Russ Dallin. He is editor-in-chief of the Latin American Herald Tribune. He is also an entrepreneur, businessman, financier, a man who knows his way around the region, and is a great resource in particular on Venezuela. And it's always a pleasure to talk with him, especially when there's been some pretty high drama there lately. Welcome back, Russ. Good to have you.
Thank you, Frank. It's always a didactic pleasure speaking with you. We always learn something.
Thank you. Well, I certainly learned something from listening to you. Russ, tell us about this assassination attempt on Nicolas Maduro over the weekend. I've seen the video of it. It was a pretty dramatic thing. Two drones apparently exploding overhead. What do you make of what happened, and what is Maduro doing in response?
Well, it's pretty amazing on so many different fronts, because it's the first attack of a drone attack on a world leader, not a world leader, but a president of a country anyway. And so we've entered a new era in that terms, where these drones have become weaponized for the democratized, if you will. I mean, we've been using drones for quite some time, but not these pretty unsophisticated $1,000 available, you know, to any hobbyist from the local Walmart kind of drones, which is what was sent to do the job. What they did is they packed or they had them carrying a payload of roughly 2 pounds each of C4. And they tried to fly them at the president when he was speaking at a military rally. But what they hadn't planned for is that the president's been using jamming equipment around him. His Cuban teams around him had been using these jamming equipments, so they lost control of the drones as they approached their target. And that's why one of them crashed, another one was exploded or was shot down in the sky as it got close.
Interesting. Well, I wonder if he had some indication this was a distinct possibility, if they took those kinds of precautions. It's interesting, because I'm not sure whether that's being done by other leaders at the head of state level. He has blamed a number of people, from expatriates to the outgoing president of Colombia. What is the current reading on who was responsible, if there is one?
Well, they have arrested six individuals so far involved, saying that some of them, they were caught with the drone iPads and everything hidden in their car as they were trying to get out of the perimeter of the situation. But as of yet, they have produced no evidence that it had to do anything with Colombia or unnamed people in Miami, as also who he also identified. They are always quick to blame the oligarchs or the right wing or Colombia, whatever suits them. But as of yet, there's been no evidence on that. We think it was homegrown. It was not a very sophisticated operation. Did not cost very much money when you're talking about $1,000 drone. And had they been someone more clued in, they would have known that they were using jamming technology around the president to prevent this kind of thing, as well as communications around him as well.
Let me ask you, Russ, more generally about the state of Venezuela at the moment. Each time we talk, it seems as though it can't get worse, and yet the collapse of the currency seems to be the latest development. Talk a bit about that.
It continues to circle the drain, I'm afraid. You know, in any other country, a drone attack on a major OPEC nation would have been big news and would have driven oil markets. And the markets disregard Venezuela at such a level that the drone attack had basically no effect on the oil prices at all. However, if Maduro had been killed, oil prices would have probably gone down because of the hopes that a more shall we say, economically sophisticated government would have taken over in place of the current idiots running the asylum in Venezuela.
I've been told that the inflation rate is simply unbelievable, 1,000,000%. Is that possible? And if so, how are people coping with it?
It is hard for us in the West to understand and even think, because when we picture hyperinflation, we all go back to that picture in our school books of the Germans carrying wheelbarrows full of Deutschmarks from the 1920s and 1930s, which helped lead to the rise of Hitler. But because of that situation, inflation is roughly right now running at a little over 3% a day. So to put it in a granular perspective, so everything, that's something that costs a dollar today is going to cost a dollar three tomorrow, and then it's going to cost a dollar seven the next day, because obviously it's inflation compounding. The IMF, the head of the IMF for Latin America, is a fellow named Alejandro Werner. He's a very intelligent fellow, and he has estimated that Venezuela inflation is likely to hit 1,000,000% a year now. That's how bad the situation is. It is incredible.
It surely can't be sustained.
Well, they lopped off five zeros off the currency. So if you had $100,000, you now have $1. This is basically what they've decided to do. And of course, they have to keep printing currency, which is quite expensive because there's a lot of counterfeiting in the area. But that's one currency that's not worth counterfeiting, because it actually costs more to produce the currency than it's actually worth. And it's completely worthless within a month.
Hey, quickly, Russ, two other things. There is an inauguration today as we speak. It is in prospect. As this broadcast airs, it will have happened, of Iván Duque's in Colombia. We were talking about the hostility between Colombia and Venezuela, but tell us very quickly about this individual and what his coming to power is likely to mean for his country.
It's great news for Colombia. Iván Duque is he's 42 years old. He becomes the 60th president of the country today. The power behind the throne is seen as Álvaro Uribe, the former president who was who beat the FARC into submission and basically made Colombia work again, if you will.
That's the terrorist organization that has now been sort of normalized by the previous government, the outgoing government.
That's true. As a matter of fact, there's some irony in the fact that Maduro was blaming Manuel Santos, who leaves office today, for this attack. Because he actually made a peace deal with the FARC, the terrorist organization that's been terrorizing the country and kidnapping and running drugs for many years. At any rate, Iván Duque is seen more in the Uribe camp, much more hardcore, and may tear away at parts of that FARC peace deal that won Manuel Santos a Nobel Peace Prize, actually, for doing that.
Yeah, let's hope so. We'll be watching this closely, as I know will you, from your vantage point as editor-in-chief of the Latin American Herald Tribune. Thank you so much for your time today, Russ Dallin. It's always good to catch up, and I'm hoping that it will be with better news in the future, particularly for Venezuela, when we talk to you in the coming days. Next up, we will speak with Kevin Freeman about Iran sanctions and economic warfare, among other things. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's a pleasure to say we are joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by Kevin Freeman, our duty expert on matters involving economic warfare, a subject he has come to be extremely knowledgeable about and helpful as a guide to for the rest of us. As a result, among other things, of his two superb and best-selling books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan, he is also the primary contributor to globaleconomicwarfare.com and the driving force behind a new television project, Economic War Room. with Kevin Freeman. It's great to have him with us. Welcome back, Kevin. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Frank.
Well, we were just talking with Russ Dallin about one of the failed states that you have written about at your blog site. And I wanted to talk to you about what's happening in Venezuela as you see it at the moment, and also President Trump's initiative with respect to the other one, Iran. Walk us through what's happening as you see it.
Well, a little more than a decade ago, Venezuela and Iran, Hugo Chavez and Ahmadinejad in Iran, became buddies. And they pledged to support one another. They pledged to be anti-American. And they both followed a socialist path. One of them is an Islamic socialist path in Iran, and the other one is in Venezuela, more of a secular path. But both of them have failed dramatically. And the dramatic failure happens every time you have a pure socialist government, and the governments are collapsing, the economy's collapsed, and if we hadn't bailed out the Iranians with the massive amounts of cash infusion from the Obama deal, they would have failed long ago.
This is so important, Kevin, because, of course, there is, as we speak, an election underway in a number of places where really, socialists are on the ballot and are seeking a mandate to become their Democratic Party's nominees for various positions in government at the state and federal level. Is there a lesson to be learned from specifically the socialist enterprise in Venezuela and Iran that, you know, is unalterably true? You had a sort of important qualification that if they are totally socialist in character, they'll fail. But what about, you know, sort of half measures that we probably would see in the immediate future, at least from some of those socialist, democratic socialists, if you will, here in this country?
Socialism always fails unless there are a few carve-out exceptions. It works for a limited time on a voluntary basis with a group of people who like each other, and that would be like a family. It doesn't work for the long term under any circumstances in any location because it has no incentives. People need the incentive to produce, and then you need some wisdom in how you spend the collective, and third-party payers are always terrible spenders. And so it fails on either how you collect the money, and then it fails on the other side how you spend the money. It never works. The market is always essential to success in economics.
And what's fascinating, it calls to mind your analysis there, Margaret Thatcher's famous dictum that the problem with it is at some point you run out of other people's money. But Kevin, the thing that makes these two failed states so extraordinary is between them, they're sitting on a very substantial percentage of the world's precious energy commodities, oil and gas. It's just unbelievable that the socialist model fails dramatically even then, as I guess it was Donald Trump who said at one point that it wasn't because they didn't have enough socialism, it was because they faithfully employed the socialist practice. And this brings us to the question of the sanctions that President Trump is now imposing on Iran. Presumably, in its present difficult straits, that will be further and perhaps catastrophic pressure on this regime. Is that how you see it? And talk a little bit about Europe's role in trying to stave off what seems to be the inevitable collapse of that regime.
Well, the Iranian regime failed years ago. The Obama administration chose to prop them up rather than allow them to fail. And with the $150 billion or whatever, tens of billions of dollars that we sent to them, the regime was a complete failure. And now, even without sanctions, it was on the path to failure. And with sanctions, that just accelerates it. And that's good. That's good news for the Iranian people. They'll get out from under a terrible regime. The Europeans, their involvement is purely greed. It's capitalism that's at work in Europe, that's in that they're wanting to make as much profit from the regime as possible rather than just letting it die as it should. And that's the other problem with socialism, is that greed comes in this cronyism where people try and carve out their piece of other people's money. And the Europeans are doing that rather than doing the right thing.
Do you think, Kevin Freeman, that President Trump will be successful, as he tweeted in his early morning missive this morning in causing the Europeans, even if they want to prop up the Iranian regime, even if they want to maintain this failed agreement, that they will have to choose to do business with the United States rather than with the Iranians, and hopefully nature will take its course as a result with that regime.
Absolutely. He is correct, because the Iranian state's going to fail. It is inevitable. And the United States, that we have free markets here and we have opportunity here. Our market's much larger. We're a much larger producer of energy. You name the item or commodity, oil included, and we're important on the more important on the world stage at this point because we have actually a system that works.
Yeah. Kevin, the Europeans are trying to basically blackmail their companies into foregoing, I guess, the opportunity to do business in the United States by threatening, you know, to punish them, as I understand it, if they do. Is that likely to work?
No. Every artificial constraint that goes against the natural market sense, it ultimately fails. It works for a short period of time. It can be artificially imposed, but it is subject to failure. And the European people will see that and at some point recognize it. And business with the United States is more important to Europe than Iran.
Yeah. At the same time this is going down, apparently there is a new piece of legislation entitled the No Oil Producing and Exporting Cartels Act, known as the NOPEC legislation. It seems to be a pretty powerful instrument of lawfare, Kevin, and of economic warfare at that. Tell us a bit about the NOPEC bill and how it might be brought to bear in a kind of form of hybrid warfare by the United States against OPEC.
Well, OPEC is a violation of market from the beginning. It is a cartel. Admittedly, it's a cartel and it violates free markets. And as a result, nations say we're going to limit our production of certain resources in order to drive the price up. And right now, the head of that OPEC effort, even though Russia is not a part of OPEC, is Russia and Saudi Arabia, because they're the two non-U.S. largest oil producers in the world. And this act, if it's passed, is a means by which there can be lawsuits brought against this non-economic activity, this non-market activity. Now, lawsuits that we produce are not enforceable. We could sue Saudi Arabia. It's not enforceable against Saudi Arabia. It's not enforceable against Russia because they're not going to accept it and so forth. But what it does open is the possibility of government sanctions. And I think that's greatly feared if our government were to sanction them for violating free market, free trading principles.
Well, they do it all the time. So it seems as though it is high time that we be pushing back against it. That'll be fascinating to watch. Kevin, let me turn to China, never far from our minds. Yesterday, we had a conversation with Gordon Chang, who indicated in his estimation that there is real and growing economic turmoil inside communist China. It may be loosening Xi Jinping's grip somewhat, but it also may result in the Chinese lashing out. How do you see the state of the Chinese economy at the moment, and what do you think might be the response of the Chinese government to their state of affairs?
Well, Gordon's been at the forefront of pointing out China's internal economic difficulties for some time. He's pointed out that there's been a smoke and mirrors economy there, in a sense, where they lure us with the promise of large markets, they steal our technology and so forth. It's propped up their markets and propped up their economy. And they're having problems. Now we're in a trade war with China, and that is causing internally much greater problems for the Chinese than it is for us, because we don't export that much to China and we import quite a bit from them. So we are in a much better position to fight this trade war. The internal problems that it's creating are very real. There's a massive debt problem inside China. They've loaned enormous amounts of money on non-economic loans. They've ignored markets and they've done what the government's wanted as opposed to what the markets have dictated. Again, it's a type of socialism-controlled economy.
Let me ask you about one other element of this that seems to be contributing to their difficulties. They have extended immense amount of loans to countries that are unable to pay them back, giving rise to something called the debt trap. associated with the building out of the Belt and Road Initiative, as it's been called. I'm told that there's some $8 trillion envisioned to go into 68 countries that are going to participate in this undertaking, and that 23 of them are facing debt distress, according to a recent report. It sounds as though Congress is beginning to push back against the idea that the International Monetary Fund will be kind of bailing out these countries when they make bad loans and then default on them to the benefit of the Chinese and their strategic ambitions. Very quickly, your thoughts on all of that?
Well, the Belt and Road Initiative is exactly what you've described. It's a geostrategic effort to use debt to entrap other nations. And then they come to the IMF and say, bail us out, and we should not be throwing money, you know, unless it can achieve our objective. We should not be throwing money to bail out their project so that they can pay back the Chinese.
Kevin Freeman, we appreciate your time today, as well as the expertise that you provide through platforms like globaleconomicwarfare.com and also the Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. Next up, Tony Badran of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies joins us. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's a pleasure to say we're joined, I believe for the first time, by Tony Badran. He is a research fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He's also a columnist and the Levant analyst for Tablet Magazine, an important online resource. His writings have appeared widely in such publications as the LA Times, the Washington Post, Foreign Affairs, and elsewhere. He was born and raised in Lebanon and has been contributing actively to the public policy debate on issues within his portfolio, including in testimony to the House of Representatives. Tony Badran, it's so good to have you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, let me start with the subject that I think you're spending a lot of time properly on, as are we, Iran. You have written at FDD about a two-front strategy that Iran is now pursuing against Israel. That actually may be evolving into even more fronts as we speak, with Hezbollah and perhaps Sinai as complements to it, maybe even Jordan. But at the moment, you've focused on Gaza and the Golan. I don't know if there's a whole lot to say about what they're doing in Gaza other than just periodic provocations, but I'm really interested in deep diving with you on what Iran is up to in the Golan area of, and Syria more generally. So can we start with that?
Sure. So when I wrote the article about the two-front strategy, it was at the time when the Iranians and whatever remains of the Assad regime, backed by Russian air power, were making their way down towards the Golan Heights in southern Syria. They had started a campaign in the south to reach all the way to the Jordanian border. That's where they started, and then they moved to the Golan side of things,
which makes up part of the border with Israel, of course.
Correct. That's on the border with exactly. So there was speculation at the time that because of Israel's red lines with regard to Iran's presence in Syria, that they might actually intervene to try to stop the advance if there were Iranian militias involved in the campaign. And so as the Iranians were doing that in southern Syria, simultaneously they were also heating up the front in Gaza with the rocket barrages that were going on against Israel.
Literally heating it up with things like fire kites as well, right?
Correct. But it had also escalated to rocket barrages specifically. And so my analysis of it was that the Iranians want to avoid in Syria specifically a full-scale war with Israel, meaning that they can absorb sort of low intensity warfare with Syria, that they can turn, if they can turn the Golan into an active front, whereby they would sort of periodically trade fire with Israel, just like they were doing in Gaza. If they can basically bog down the Israelis in two low intensity fronts to deter them from taking decisive action in either one. That's the idea. So that if you could forestall a decisive Israeli action to take out sort of Iranian assets in a particular region, then they can kind of drag out this this process to establish and entrench themselves further. Now, I think insofar as they have already reached the Golan Heights, they're there. The question now is how Israel is going to handle it, which is going to be what we're going to witness in the months and weeks to come.
And Tony, let me just be clear. Are you saying that there are actually Iranian forces at the Golan, not just their proxies, whether it's maybe Iranians, even in Syrian uniforms for that matter, but Syrian forces or perhaps Hezbollah? This is something that I've long understood was a red line for Israel, was keeping them at least 60 or 80 kilometers away from that frontier.
Well, the Israelis actually aren't satisfied with just keeping them away, however many kilometers from the frontier. They want them out of Syria entirely. So the Russians actually have proposed that, hey, look, we can actually get into a process where we can gradually start to remove them from the border with the Golan Heights. And the Israelis said, no, you know, we're going to continue to hit them in Syria regardless because they need to be out of there entirely. The reason is very simple. If they set up missile capabilities 150, 200 kilometers into Syria, away from the border, it doesn't matter. That missile is still going to be able to hit Israel anyway, so it doesn't make a difference for the Israelis. But whether the Iranians themselves are present in the south or Hezbollah, I mean, I don't make a distinction between the Iranians and Hezbollah. Hezbollah, as far as I'm concerned, is a unit of the IRGC. So it's not, to me, that's a distinction without meaning, really. But we do know that Hezbollah is there. They've said that they're there. They've boasted openly that they're there. We do know that other IRGC-commanded Shiite militias, both Syrian and non-Syrian, are very much embedded and integrated with whatever remains of the Assad regime's so-called government forces. So that is something that we do know, that they're there. Now, the question is, you know, are the Israelis going to take action simply against sort of militia presence, or are they going to occupy themselves more with infrastructure for the time being rather than just personnel?
They have been going after the Iranian infrastructure, and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, or IRGC, has been taking some incomings as a result.
We detailed this, all of this interaction between Israel and Iran, this kind of shadow war, or more than now, it's kind of a heating up front in Syria, in a report for FDD that we released recently, which you can find at our website. It's called Controlled Chaos.
Indeed. Let me ask you, in terms of all of this business with Syria, you alluded to the Russians. What is Putin up to at the moment, and what does it portend?
So this was the subject of much speculation as the campaign to retake southern Syria was ongoing, that, you know, the Israelis are going to cut a deal with the Russians and that the Russians are going to remove the Iranians from the border. And this kind of speculation has been going on since May or June. And of course, with every report that a deal had been reached, you see the Israelis coming out and said, no, there is no deal, actually. And then the terms of the deal continued to change, like we discussed earlier. Well, how many kilometers, how many this, how many that? All of this is just idle speculation, because for the Israelis, they want the Iranians out of Syria. And Russia is we can debate whether it's willing or not, but it's unclear if it's even capable to achieve that, to remove Iranians from Syria, especially as the Iranians are deeply entrenched there, but also they are also the foot soldiers for the Assad regime, whose manpower is actually depleted. So I think rather the Russians, as I wrote in another piece, is that the Russians actually are much more comfortable with simply positioning themselves in the middle, so that both the Israelis and the Iranians kind of have to petition them in a way, and they become the central interlocutor for everything.
Yeah. When you say position themselves in the middle, you mean sort of in a geostrategic sense, rather than physically interposing their forces between the Israelis and the Iranians. They're not interested in doing that, I take it.
Exactly. No, they won't. Actually, that's precisely the point, that they want to be out of the ways,
but still calling the shots.
Exactly. As long as the Israelis don't hit Bashar al-Assad, and as long as the Israelis don't hit Russian personnel and systems that are positioned in Syria, the Russians are perfectly fine with the Iranians getting hit, and don't care if the Iranians set up their own infrastructure either. The only thing, this is the caveat that the Israelis are possibly considering using as leverage with the Russians, which is to say that we have the possibility, and this is something we discussed in the report, we have the ability, meaning Israel has the ability to actually flip the table on the Russians in Syria, because it can jeopardize its entire enterprise in Syria if it goes after the Assad regime. So the Assad regime becomes the weak link here.
When you say it, you mean if the Israelis go after the Assad regime, they stop holding back on that front.
Correct. Or if the escalation between Iran and Israel grows such that it jeopardizes the Assad regime and therefore the position of the Russians in Syria, then all of a sudden maybe they're thinking that this might change the Russians' calculations. I still think that the default position for the Russians, though, is to simply try to sit it out and let everybody come to Moscow and petition them.
Be the power broker. Yeah. Let me turn to one last item on this front, if I could, with you, Tony Bedran of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. The domestic turmoil in Iran is increasingly colored, it seems, by hostility, not just towards the regime there, but specifically towards what is widely seen as the impoverishing of the Iranian people by the diversion of funding that should be going to them and their desperate needs for drinking water, for heaven's sakes, among other things, in order to fund such projects as Iran's hegemonic activities in Syria and, you know, supporting Hezbollah and supporting Hamas and, of course, Assad's regime as well. What are your thoughts on how this is likely to sort out? Might this be the solution to the problem for Israel if the regime is preoccupied at home at the very least and at best is brought down?
Well, I mean, that's all remains to be seen. We're not quite sure yet how these demonstrations, which have been going on really for a year, although they've certainly picked up intensity in the last couple of months, but especially as the Trump administration pulled out of the deal, the Iran deal, the nuclear deal, and now has reimposed sanctions just yesterday. So I think that as far as the Israelis are concerned, that any pressure on the Iran regime at home is a good thing. If it does translate into their inability to fund an enterprise in Syria, that's a good thing. Whether that will actually lead to the regime's collapse is an open question.
Tony Bedran, we are hard out of time, I'm afraid. Thank you so much for yours today and for the work you're doing at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. I hope you'll have a chance to come back to us soon. In the meantime, I look forward to reading more of your writing at Tablet Magazine. Keep it up. We'll talk with you in the near future. Next up, Rowan Scarborough joins us from the Washington Times on the latest on Russia's influence operations and what it might mean for us. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It is a pleasure always to have with us Rowan Scarborough. He is one of the great investigative reporters of our times. He writes these days for the Washington Times as its national security reporter. He's the author of two superb books, Rumsfeld's War and Sabotage. We very much appreciate his time, and especially on some of the subjects that he's been covering in a way that brings a clarity to much confusing, indeed overwhelming information day in and day out, particularly with respect to the interrelated stories of Russian influence operations and allegations of collusion on the part of the Trump campaign. It's, again, the sort of thing that we really need help with. So, Rowan Scarborough, thank you for providing it. Welcome back. It's good to have you.
Thanks a lot, Frank.
Well, at the moment, Rowan, as you know, President Trump is being soundly thrashed over the fact that he mentioned that what happened in Trump Tower in 2016 in a meeting involving a Russian lawyer was opposition research. First of all, Was that particularly surprising to you or devastating as an admission? Or was it, in fact, the only instance in campaign 2016 of political figures seeking help from Russian operatives in the way of opposition research?
Yeah, I would just point out that it was Trump's Russian entertainment friends in Moscow who suggested that they meet with this lawyer who was coming into town on a case related to a forfeiture claim by the Justice Department against this rich Russian. So she had a visa to come into the country for that court hearing, and some of his friends in Russia say she has some dirt on Hillary, you ought to listen to her. So that's how the meeting came about. And in the end, according to all the participants, she had nothing. She basically wanted to argue about lifting sanctions on her client to help her client's business. That's what it came down to. And number two, from the get-go, as soon as that meeting was disclosed by the New York Times, Donald Jr. said it was to collect, to see if there was Oppo research on Hillary, and there wasn't. July 2017, President Trump said it was for Oppo research. He tweeted that. He said it at a press conference. So his tweet a couple of days ago was the exact same thing he said in July of a year ago.
And so you're saying, Rowan Scarborough, if I understand you correctly, that this was not the Russian government that was offering information about Hillary Clinton through this agent of the government. This was all sort of a private sector enterprise, admittedly involving a foreign source. But how does that compare to what Mrs. Clinton's team was doing through Fusion GPS and the Christopher Steele dossier?
Well, at the very moment this Trump Tower meeting happened in early June, the Clinton campaign and the DNC had provided money to Fusion GPS to hire an ex-British spy to then plumb the depths of the Kremlin with money in hand to try to collect dirt on Donald Trump. And that began in early June, and it proceeded all during the campaign. He began filing memos that were briefed to the Clinton campaign, coming directly from the Kremlin on all sorts of conspiracy allegations against Trump and his people. So while there was one brief scattershot meeting at Trump Tower in June 2016, on the Clinton side, there was a methodical financed operation to gain information from Russian sources, Russian government sources, about Donald Trump, and then using that information in the campaign by spreading it to the news media in Washington and getting them to write articles at which they were somewhat successful, and also to get it into a letter that Harry Reid wrote in August of 2016, which he then leaked to the New York Times, and that made news, and that letter was right out of the dossier.
And you've also been reporting, Rowan Scarborough, that in roughly this same period, this dossier was injected into a U.S. government counterintelligence operation aimed at exploring beyond what the press would do with this information, whether there was some evidence that not only was there collusion, but that there was a penetration of that campaign. Is that right?
I mean, the FBI in the summer of 2016 was using one or more confidential human sources to penetrate the Trump campaign, and they also began to embrace this dossier, this unverified, discredited dossier, to guide their investigation, who they interviewed, what they asked them, and then also, of course, to get at least one wiretap, court-ordered wiretap that we know of against a Trump person that went on for a year. So just to compare that, one Trump Tower meeting for 20 minutes with a private Russian attorney compared to the Clinton finance dossier, which is being spread in the media and the government and being used by the FBI to target Trump people. It's quite a contrast.
It is. At the very best, it's sort of a deflection to get the focus away from what the Clinton team was up to towards the Trump program. But it really does, I think, when you net it all together, it really comes down to an egregious abuse of power. And I think we're still reaping the whirlwind of it. Talk about, you wrote recently about having marked the third anniversary of this counterintelligence operation. What have we learned? How would you distill down the bottom line of all of this as best it can be discerned?
Well, on July 31st is when they officially opened the probe, 2016. So we've passed the two-year mark, although it's obvious they were investigating Trump before that. I don't know what constitutes an official start as opposed to we're investigating him. But anyway, 2 years later, we still do not have any firm public evidence of what the dossier accused Trump of, which was an extensive, quote, conspiracy between Trump and the Kremlin to interfere in the election. So 2 years later, publicly, we do not have any evidence of that. We have the Trump Tower meeting, and we have Roger Stone briefly communicating with Guccifer II, who turned out to be a Russian agent that people did not know at the time. And that's about it, Frank. I mean, that's about all I can see.
Yeah. And Rowan, when you listen to those who are in such high dudgeon about this, notably the Adam Schiffs of the world, the ranking member of the Intelligence Committee in the House, and they insist that they've seen evidence of collusion, do you find pretty compelling comments of people like, I think it was Marco Rubio, who said, if there were any evidence, Adam Schiff would have leaked it by now? Where do you think this stands? I mean, are we really being misled by those who insist that actually there's some there?
Adam Schiff's side methodically leaked things out of the House investigation for over a year, some of them which turned out to be wholly inaccurate, wholly wrong. And as you say, Frank, or as Senator Rubio says, if Adam Schiff had evidence of this collusion to hack or collusion in social media, he would have leaked it by now. It's obvious. So what he wants to do is wants to keep the investigation going because he thinks he's going to be Intel chairman come January 2019. And he's going to crank up the investigation again.
You bet. Hey, before we let you go, Rowan Scarborough, just very quickly, you are, of course, first and foremost, a national security guy. I was interested in getting your thoughts on the announcements last week by, I believe it was four senior U.S. government officials, most of them with some involvement in the intelligence domain, warning about the influence operations that are continuing to be run. They mentioned Russia. I don't think they spoke about China's, or for that matter, the Muslim Brotherhood's. But just your quick take on what was said there and its significance.
Well, we know FBI Director Wray 2 weeks ago said that China influence operation in this country, all the others pale in comparison as to what China is doing to infiltrate our country. I think they came out, it's all related to Helsinki, where the president kind of botched the question that he knew he was going to get at that press conference. And then Democrats began saying he doesn't take this seriously. And so I think basically his war cabinet wanted to show the American people that we're on top of this. Despite Helsinki, Putin is still trying to penetrate our internet infrastructure to disrupt our democracy.
Rowan Scarborough, thank you for the terrific work you do with the Washington Times and for joining us from time to time. I hope you'll do so again in the near future. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.